This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva, joining you live broadcast from Efrat in Gush Etzion in the Judean Hills, a series that we are now undertaking on Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's monumental essay, his magnum opus, Halachic Man. I just put my email in the chat box, Jeffrey Sachs, JeffreySachs at gmail.com. For you to feel free to have an open channel of communication with me. Those of you that are joining us in the archive, either those of you that will be listening to the archive in just a few hours after the discussion is broadcast, and those of you that will be listening in the archives at some point in the distant future, I hope I'm still here with you, at some point in the distant future, months or even years from now, welcome to you out there in the future. Please feel free to be in touch with us whenever it is that you are listening to these talks with your questions, with your comments, with your thoughts on what it is that we're learning. It's a strange thing about Web Yeshiva. The other day I got an email from someone who was listening to a recording from something that we did the first year in 2007, asking me questions on something I taught back then, and I was very flattered that they imagined I would remember what it is that I had said in 2007. It forced me to actually go and get the recording and listen to it again. But these shiurim are now beginning in January 2014. I don't know when they'll be ending. I don't know how long they will be. I don't know how many sessions we will dedicate to trying to get our hands and minds around this very important work, Halachic Man, which I'm calling an essay, although of course we have it published in book form, a slim book, but in book form, and I use those terms interchangeably. You know, we're liable to, if we make our way through, and I bent to the pressure that some of you brought to bear, that we should dedicate our study to this particular text. Over the past number of years, we've studied quite a few of Rabbi Soloveitchik's shorter essays together, and this really is a daunting undertaking, and one that I must admit I've put off a little bit over the years to teach in this form. I've had an opportunity to teach and learn the essay with students in other settings in the past, and you know that's the nature of how Web Yeshiva is. We'll begin and we'll continue until we come to the end, and whenever that'll be, maybe we'll have a chance to meet together in Yerushalayim and celebrate. But it's liable to be more than a few weeks. I can't promise that we'll study each page, each paragraph, each sentence in depth. That would take us forever. But I do hope that over the course of however long it will be, we will really be able to make a comprehensive study of Halachic Man and the ideas that stand behind it. Just a few technical notes as we begin this task. Of course, Halachic Man was the Rav's signature essay, so much so that he himself is often called the Halachic Man. I think actually the term, the Ish HaHalacha, in Hebrew, is engraved on his very tombstone. However, that is not to say that the colloquial use of the phrase Halachic Man, which I think has come to mean someone who is very committed to halachic observance, which is of course something we all ought to strive for, that is not the end-all and be-all of the definition of this typological character we're about to meet, the Halachic Man, the titular character of this essay we're about to begin. It's far more complicated than that, as we shall see. Second point, man, as was the nature of an essay written in the 1940s and perhaps formulated even earlier, the Rav writes in gendered language, but there is nothing at all in the essay that would limit itself to men over women, but since it would be not possible to stop and make this caveat each and every time, he does use gendered language. I'm just going to put a footnote into the conversation here and let it stand throughout the rest of our discussion that all of the discussions of the religious personality as depicted in the halachic man, the religious man, the scientific man, the cognitive man, are equally true to men and to women. And the essay is, of course, stylistically a product of its times before these sensitivities came into focus. Number three, the degree to which halachic man really has become Rabbi Soloveitchik's signature philosophical essay should not overshadow lots of other things that he wrote. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not a systematic philosopher. And if you look at the corpus of his writings that were left behind, both those published in his life by him, those published by students during his lifetime, either with or without his revision, and certainly those that have been published now posthumously, you can put together some kind of eclectic philosophy, but not every two essays necessarily perfectly correlate. He wrote over many decades reflections of the thinkings of a young man, a middle-aged man, an old man. His thinking on certain things evolved, although remarkably there were certain themes that he stuck with and came back to again and again and again and again. The attempt to try to correlate all of his writing and all of his thinking would by definition be somewhat frustrating. Many of you were with us in a series that we had, a year or two ago, looking at The Lonely Man of Faith, perhaps his second most significant essay. We should say that to a certain degree, the halachic man is a character that he portrays here with great passion, with great admiration. But to a certain degree, he does not fully identify with this character of the halachic man in a number of important ways. And as we move through the essay, we encounter those points. I will try to make a point of showing the areas in which he himself does not fully identify with this character that he portrays with great adoration. And to a certain degree, this other character that he portrays, the lonely man of faith, the Isha Emunah, is much closer to how he views his own inner religious life in practice. In that essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, I gave, by way of introduction, a full lecture that was a kind of overview of Rabbi Soloveitchik's biography and his introduction to his thought and some of the major trends. I'm not going to repeat all of that now because many of you were in that talk, and over the years I've made reference back to that, and it is archived and on the homepage on webyeshiva.org for this particular course on this particular first session. There's a link there to get to that. To get to that introductory session for anybody that feels some more background to the man and his work and his mind would be useful, and I certainly recommend that to you. Just briefly stated, of course, Rabbi Soloveitchik was born in 1903 and died in 1993, and spent the bulk of his career, although he was of course born in Europe, educated principally by his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. We spoke about his father in our last session, series of talks on the essay Kodesh and Chol, which was delivered as a memorial lecture for his father. He went off at a certain point to study philosophy, receiving a PhD at the University of Berlin. And those of you that have made your way through or have attempted to make your way through Halachic Man will see that there are many, many references to philosophical trends and movements and ideas and thinkers, and presumably encountered these in his academic studies. He moves to the United States, settles in Boston, upon the death of his father in 1941, he is appointed as Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the Yeshiva division at Yeshiva University in New York, continues to live in Boston and commutes back and forth. In Boston, he was the rabbi of the Orthodox community and was the founder of the Maimonides School, first an elementary and then a high school. But his principal perch for teaching and influencing American Judaism and American Orthodoxy was from within Yeshiva University. And he became something of the symbolic head of what we today call modern Orthodoxy, even though that was a term that he did not use. And the community, the modern Orthodox community, if we look at it today, and then in his day, would have been something that was not, which he would have identified with, but with a great deal of reservation and with a great deal of critique. He was not easily placeable into any one box. His principal mode of communication and education was through his Talmud shiur, his Gemara shiur in yeshiva, where many thousands of students passed through, many of whom went on to become rabbis and leaders of the Jewish community in the United States and elsewhere. But he also was a public intellectual and spoke on a variety of topics, and he was a spokesman for halachic Judaism. Now, this term halacha, of course, means Jewish law. This nickname for the system of Jewish law, halacha, literally from the term lalechet, to walk, the path in which we must walk, is the halacha. Halacha has two different meanings that are used somewhat confusingly but interchangeably. I'll say, although this is not the typography that's used in the book, halacha with a lowercase h, halacha in its common sense means laws. So someone might ask, if on Rosh Chodesh I forgot to say Yalla V'Yavo in Mincha, what's the halacha? Meaning, what's the din? What's the law? What's the status? What's the halacha of a meat spoon that fell into a milk pot? That's what we mean in the kind of garden variety use of the term. But halacha with a capital H, the way it's used here in the title of this book and throughout much of the book, is a synonym that Rabbi Soloveitchik favored for what other thinkers might have referred to as Judaism or Torah, or the Jewish worldview, or the Jewish hashkafa, or the Jewish philosophy. Rabbi Soloveitchik believed to the very core of his being that the halachic system, the system of Jewish law, which, again, we have to be clear on, doesn't just mean the kind of black on white law books, but the philosophical principles and ethics that stand behind the halachic system, that was the source of Jewish philosophy. More than anything else, that is the source of Jewish thought and Jewish philosophy and the authentic Jewish worldview. Now, in so doing, he was partially motivated. When I say the halachic system, I mean principally that embodied in the Talmud, in the Gemara, in the oral law, but the entirety of the Jewish corpus of Jewish writing, Jewish legal writing. The essay was originally published in Hebrew in 1944 in the journal Talpiot. There was a journal of rabbinic organization, I believe. It was published in 1944 in Talpiot in Hebrew. And it was only translated into English in 1983 by Lawrence Kaplan in this edition that we have. There are a number of different printings of the book, but they're all identical. The pagination of all of them is identical on the inside, regardless of which cover it looks like, although almost all of them have this, some have this little symbol, the book having had won the National Jewish Book Award when it came out at some point. It's been published by different publishers, I think, over the years, but the inside is all the same. So whichever edition you have, it's going to be universal pagination. There's never been a second edition or anything like that. I will make certain pages scanned available for our study together, but I do strongly, strongly, strongly recommend that everybody get a copy of the book. To the best of my knowledge, it is not available as an ebook. If somebody finds that I am wrong, please definitely send me the link so that we can share it with everyone else. But it is available in the United States, at least. It is available in on Amazon and other books. It's available. You can buy it used at a discount. Here in Israel, it's usually available in the bookstores that sell English Torah books, and sometimes even in the major book chains like Stamatsky and Somet Svarim and the like. It certainly can be ordered. I do very strongly recommend that if you will be along with us on this ride, however long it will be for us to make a headway into the through the book, that you get a copy for yourselves. And it is, of course, an essential component of any well-stocked contemporary Jewish library. Yes, and thank you, Dov. There's a link to the book on Amazon. And again, I find that buying these books, secondhand, used on Amazon, it's usually fine, and you can sometimes save a great deal of money. I posted a few different things, and I'm sure as we go along, I'll be posting many, many more things, and I'll try to make reference to people that have had intelligent things to say on Halachic Man. I did post the link when the book was translated in 1983 by Lawrence Kaplan. Unfortunately, it did not include an index, which is an unfortunate thing for something that is such an essential text. And a couple of years ago, I prepared an index which appeared in the journal, the Torah Mada Journal, and it's an index by of sources, as well as of names. Now, if you'll notice, there are very many names of people that that appear throughout the book. And one of the things that I tried to do was to identify who the characters are. And since there are, of course, very many people mentioned in the book or quoted in the book or in the footnotes from the world of philosophy or the philosophy of science or the like, I tried to indicate, you know, who these are. So you'll see just by wide variety, here's philosophers. So I give these little biographical blurbs of who they were. Were they a Tana or an Amora or a biblical character, or a Christian scholastic, or an Italian philosopher and theologian, or a Greek philosopher of the 4th century BCE, etc. So some may find this useful just for these little biographical blurbs that you have in the back about the names of the people that are mentioned throughout the book. And just it's fun just to look through these few pages to look who's mentioned the variety of people that are referred to and cited in this whatever it is, 130-page essay that he was able to populate it with references to this, to every major figure in the world of ideas from the Bible up until modern philosophy. It's quite remarkable. And then there's, of course, a subject index in the book. So this may be useful to you if you're going to try to do a careful study. You're welcome, of course, to print it out and to stick it into the back of your book. One final note before we start looking at the text. As I said, the essay was published in Hebrew in 1944, but it's very clearly the product of ideas that he had been engaging with a number of years before. Very rarely, perhaps never, did Rabbi Soloveitchik, very rarely did Rabbi Soloveitchik sit down and write something out, original, first draft, kind of from scratch. Like many thinkers, he would experiment with ideas, he would toss ideas around, and since his major forum for educating was not through print, but through teaching, he would deliver talks and lectures, and you can see over the course of a few years, his thinking, coming out on different things. The idea of the dichotomy of man, which we see in the opening lines here, which we see again 20 years later in The Lonely Man of Faith, which we see in early essays and later essays, in essays like Majesty and Humility, which we studied together a number of years ago, and the like. These are ideas that were kind of essential, and he used to organize his thinking, and he would teach, and he would speak, and then at a certain point he would commit the ideas to paper. Again, even though the essay was originally written in Hebrew, I was told by an eyewitness that the entirety of the essay was delivered almost word for word as a lecture a number of years earlier, before his arrival at Yeshiva University of Rosh Hashiva, which again was in 1941. At some point in the late 30s, he was invited to deliver some kind of major address at Yeshiva University, and he delivered what was essentially the content of what became this essay, the Ish HaHalacha, the man of the halachic man. And I was told by Rav Yisrael Shurin, Zichron Levracha, Zechatzah Levracha, who was a neighbor of mine in Efrat. He was a Rav in the United States. Rav Shurin, who's one of the Rav's early students. He was actually one of the Rav's students initially in Boston. There was a small group of students that gathered around the Rav in Boston before he came to YU. It was Rav Shurin, who was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's son-in-law, among other things, and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's brother-in-law. He was a brother-in-law to the Rav's younger brother. He was present at this talk in the late 30s at Yeshiva University, and the Rav delivered it as a talk, and it was delivered in English. And there may have been certain kind of agenda to deliver such talk in English to show that this European rabbi had command of the language. And I remember of Shurin Zichron Levracha telling me that when the Rav described how lonely the halachic man is, not the same kind of loneliness that the lonely man feels, but the loneliness of the halachic man, that he has only the four cubits, the arba amot of halacha, said the Rav cried. And it was a very dramatic moment. But then for whatever reason, when the work was committed to paper, it was written in Hebrew, and then again only translated back into English almost 40 years later by Lawrence Kaplan, but with the Rav's involvement. Rabbi Soloveitchik was involved in and reviewed the translation we are looking at. The essay itself, the book itself, is divided into two sections, part one and part two. Part one is much larger. It runs about 95 pages, and it's subtitled Halachic Man, His Worldview and His Life. It's a phenomenological examination of this archetype that he paints, this halachic man, this kind of pure form, which he did again and again and again and again. Instead of kind of stating a philosophical worldview in the abstract, he creates this archetype, this embodiment of that worldview, describes him so that we can then understand what it is. It's kind of like a kind of reverse engineering. We're going to describe a kind of ideal, a certain platonic ideal of a particular worldview, and we're going to do it by showing you the practitioner, the embodiment of that worldview. And he did this in many occasions, this kind of typological, phenomenological examination, where he would say, there's such a thing as the halakha, and the halakha with a capital H. And the halakha itself is the repository of what Judaism strives for. Not every person achieves that, but what would it look like if we had a hero, if we had one person that was the fulfillment of the vision? So let's call him the halachic man. Let's call him the halachic man. The same thing with the lonely man of faith. The same thing with the Ish Yom HaKippurim, or the Ish Rosh Chodesh, where he would kind of take an idea and say, Rosh Chodesh is about something. So let's imagine Rosh Chodesh man. You know, almost like you can imagine like the comic book editions of these things. You know, like with the superheroes, where the superheroes become you know, some kind of the embodiment of a certain power. I'm trying to be humorous here. But I'm sure I'm not the first one that put forth this idea. That's what this kind of type of typological presentation that he favored was. He often did this in hespedim, in eulogies that he would deliver for friends or colleagues or teachers or important rabbinic leaders that passed on. And he, as a world famous orator, which he was, would be asked to deliver a eulogy for the deceased. And very often, instead of speaking about the person who died, he would say, the dearly departed, he was all about this or all about that. He would try to distill the person into a personality type. And then he would say, he was a person of this quality. And he would describe the exemplar of that quality in the abstract, in a kind of archetype, and then go back and tell you that that person was like this. There have been actually some very interesting studies of the Rav as a maspid, the Rav as a eulogizer, that, you know, is examining the eulogies he delivered, many of which were subsequently written down and published, the use of the eulogy as a kind of rhetorical tool. And in those formats, he would do a similar kind of thing. This essay, the first part is that kind of typological, phenomenological description, and that's the first largest half. Full three quarters of the essay is this part one, the descriptive part. And then the second, much shorter part, part two, which we'll get to at some point in the distant future, is called His Creative Capacity. That runs only about 35 pages, and that is focusing on one particular characteristic of the halachic man, his penchant for creativity. And we'll have to spend some time when we get there talking about what he means by creativity. In this first major philosophical essay, the essay is not dedicated to anyone, but the spirit of his father, who had died just a few years, three years before the essay was published, his father and his grandfather, the great Reb Chaim Brisker, and his uncle, who at the time, of course, was still alive, Reb Velvel, the Brisker of Jerusalem, these three men, his father, his grandfather, and his uncle, may have been the only true embodiments of halachic men you know, in his life or in his experience. And it's not surprising that he opens the book with this, oh, what's the word for that? That little quote that opens a work, not the leitmotif, the, oh, it'll come back to me, but with this quote from the Gemara in Sota, at that moment, an epigram. At that moment, the image of his father came to him and appeared before him in the window. And that, of course, is the Gemara's description, which Rashi quotes, about Yosef HaTzadik in Beit Potiphar, as Potiphar's wife is trying to seduce young Joseph because of his beauty, and he's tempted to sin, the image of his father, the image of Yaakov, comes to him, and that's what protects him there in the face of temptations. And it's a very, significant quote. First of all, he himself was a Yosef, and he himself was a Yosef who went off and found himself in a setting very different than his father's home in which he was raised. To go off to be a young son and grandson of rabbinic royalty in Poland, in Lithuania, in parts of the world where he grew up, to go off to the university in Berlin, and to be exposed to a world of ideas that were completely foreign to everything in his upbringing. Well, it's not the sexual temptation of Yosef in Potiphar's house, but it is a temptation. It is an exposure to things, and the idea that the image of his father, the image of his grandfather, the image of his uncle stands before him and lets him keep his bearings is quite significant here at the beginning, particularly of this essay. So let's begin, after that rather lengthy introduction, let's begin by rolling up our sleeves and at least making our way through the first chapter. Again, the book is subdivided into two parts, and then each part is divided into these chapters. Halachic man reflects two opposing selves. Again, the halachic man is this pure ideal type. In reality, it could be no one is a pure ideal type. But if you take, we're all hybrids. I remind you of what we discover when we get to the end of the essay, The Lonely Man of Faith. The description of Adam 1 and Adam 2, these two types of religious personalities, the majestic man and the covenantal man. And in the end, of course, the Rav is very clear. None of us, no one person is either or. We are a hybrid. We contain multitudes. There are different aspects to our personalities, and there are different aspects to our religious personalities. But kind of putting the religious personality into a centrifuge and divvying it up into its kind of pure components helps us understand something about the kind of complex hybrid and mixture of disparate forces that each of us contains in our own personality. Halachic man reflects two opposing selves. Two disparate images are embodied within his soul and spirit. So halachic man is this hybrid of two different opposing forces. On the one hand, he is as far removed from homo religiosus as East is from West, and is identical in many respects to prosaic cognitive man. Prosaic meaning prose, meaning the unpoetic. There are two disparate characters. And the halachic man he possesses both of them. It's like a yin and a yang that are pulling within the personality of halachic man. But yet halachic man is greater than the sum of these two parts. Now these two characters are cognitive man, in Hebrew, the ish hada'at, the man of knowledge, cognition, thought. We might identify him as the scientist, but again, the kind of pure image of what a scientist is. I mean, don't tell me that a lot of scientists are religious. They are. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about the man who approaches the world through the prism of science alone, through the prism of pure knowledge alone, through the prism of pure reason. And he nicknames this character Cognitive Man. Cognitive Man. And the opposing force is Homo Religiosus. In Latin, there's no hard G. I learned from years of high school Latin. So it's Homo Religiosus, or Religious Man. Wait, is there a typo there? No, no typo. Homo Religiosus, or Religious Man. Now, you would think that being a religious man is the highest peak that we should aim for. But that's not the way in which he uses the term here, and we'll see. So he kind of sets up these straw men, these two characters, the scientist and the religious man. In Hebrew, there's a good play on words, because in Hebrew, hold on a second, in Hebrew, cognitive man is ish had. A better color there. Ish hada'at, and religious man is ish hadat. You see that? The words are not etymologically related, but it's a good play on words. Da'at, with an ayin, is knowledge, and dat is religion. So in the Hebrew version, you have this nice play on words. But in English, for some reason, they chose these two terms. Interestingly, one is in Latin and one is in English. But this idea of the homo religiosus, the religious man, as this kind of typical figure of what religion is, is spelled out. It's just on one hand, halachic man, who's like greater than the sum of the parts and stands above the other two, but yet contains both of them pulling at him. On the one hand, halachic man is as far removed from homo religiosus as east is from west. In some ways, he's identical to cognitive man. In some ways, halachic man is closer to the scientist than he is to the religious personality, the kind of conventionally understood man of the spirit. That's very interesting. That the first thing we learn about halachic man is that in some ways he is closer to Steve, I think you're chatting things into the chat box. I'm not sure if they're meant for me, or if you're meant to be, if you're communicating one-on-one with someone else, but I'm not sure that I'm following what you're writing. On the other hand, halachic man, epigraph, that's what it is, not epigraph. Halachic man is, of course, a man of God, possessor of an ontological approach. Let's go back to the text. Possessor of an ontological approach that is devoted to God and of a worldview saturated with the radiance of the divine presence. Ontological, this is one of these words. I mean, I don't know what you should do. I mean, we're in need of an annotated edition of halachic math. And as we go through, maybe one of you wants to prepare it. But, you know, in the old days, we would like jot a note on the side margin of the book after we looked up what ontological was. Ontology is the philosophical school that examines the study of being and existence. So the ontological approach, the ontological worldview of halachic man means that when he looks at the world, when he looks at creation, the way he interprets the world around him is principally a religious worldview. And he's going to define and give examples of all these things as he moves on. But this is part of the two opposing selves, the disparate images. On one hand, he's the scientist. And again, by scientist, I mean this kind of a stereotypical image of the scientist that interprets the world through one prism. But on the other hand, he's a man of the spirit. For this reason, it is difficult to analyze halachic man's religious consciousness by applying the terms and traits that descriptive psychology and modern philosophy of religion have used to characterize religious personality. He says, we can't think about halachic man, we can't describe or study halachic man with the same tools and descriptors that the sociology of religion uses to describe religious people. Because he is not a religious person only. He possesses the same rigor and logic and analytical skills and a kind of rational and objective antenna and radar that the scientist uses, that the physicist uses to examine the world. But at the same time, and therefore it would be impossible to kind of study this character of the halachic man with the same criteria that are used by religious philosophers and sociologists of religion and psychologists looking at the nature of religious personality, because he doesn't fit into that box of the conventional religious personality. But on the other hand, of course, he's not a scientist, because he is a man of the spirit. He has an ontological approach which is devoted to God and the world view saturated with radiance and the divine presence. And therefore, we need to invent a new category, a new set of linguistic tools and analytical tools to figure out what this creature is. The image that halachic man presents is singular, is unique, even strange. He is of a type that is unfamiliar to students of religion. But if, in the light of modern philosophy, homo religiosus in general has come to be regarded as an antithetical being, fraught with contradictions, who wrestles with his consciousness and struggles with the tribulations of the dualism of affirmation and negation, affirmation and denigration, how much more so is it true of halachic man? So now he's saying that, but wait a second, even in the study of religion today, writing in the 1940s, the religious man is under critique, because you start peeling away the layers of the onion and you see it's very complicated under there. The religious personality is a very complex being. How much more so halachic man, who comprises the religious personality and surpasses him and stands on his shoulders. It's important to remember, and we're going to come back to this momentarily, if not tonight, then next week, it's important to always remember the milieu in which the essay was thought and spoken and written. Religion in the 1940s in the United States, and then progressively more so throughout the 1950s and 60s, was a very complex Okay, was a very complex phenomena. Religion, of course, was on the decline. It's beginning to be on the decline, and the early 1940s when it's formulated. Maybe the late 30s, published in 1944. World War II is still going on, of course, but certainly after the soldiers come home, certainly after World War II concludes, religious life in America really begins to undergo a very great revision. Judaism in particular, we begin to see the rise of the conservative and reform movements in a way that they had not, with a strength they had not had beforehand, and the very serious decline of orthodoxy. And as I mentioned about a few other things, including that last series that we had, and very much of what Rabbi Soloveitchik was doing in that mid part of the 20th century, there is to a certain degree a polemical element on behalf of orthodoxy. The conscious decision to frame Jewish philosophy from within the framework and language of halakha was not accidental. And there is a certain defense of halachic Judaism, of orthodox Judaism, that's at play here. And the critique of the religious personality, the conventional religious personality, before you get to this exalted hybrid halachic man, was part of the spirit of the times, both against Jewish religious personalities as well as religious personalities in general. Halachic man is an antinomic type for dual reason. Antinomic means he's a paradox, he's a contradiction. The halachic man is a walking contradiction, and that's for two reasons. Number one, he bears within the deep recesses of his personality the soul of homo religiosus, that soul which, as was stated above, suffers from the pangs of self-contradiction and self-negation. He has the soul of the religious man. Halachic man has the soul of religious man. It's bad enough that halachic man is torn between religious man and scientific man, between cognitive man and homo religiosus. But a homo religiosus himself is suffering a split personality. So halachic man is going to suffer it doubly so. So the self-contradiction, the paradox, which is halachic man, comes A, from the fact that he bears the same split of personality and soul that all religious men have, because he is also a religious man, although that's not the totality of his being. And number two, at the same time, halachic man's personality also embraces the soul of cognitive man. And this soul contradicts all the desires and strivings of the religious soul. He's got this split personality. It's interesting, of course, that he says he is the soul of cognitive man. I might have thought he would have said that the halachic man is a contradiction because he has the soul of religious man and the mind of cognitive man. He has the heart of the religious personality and the mind of the scientific personality, and that's the source. But interestingly, he doesn't choose that as the metaphor he uses. I don't know if I'm making too much of this, but he says that he's got the soul of and the soul of the cognitive man. And the soul of the cognitive man contradicts all of the desires and strivings, the spiritual strivings, that is, of the religious soul. However, these opposing forces, which struggle together in the religious consciousness of halachic man, are not of a destructive or disjunctive nature. And here begins the real innovation. And if it's not an innovation for you, if it's not a chidush for you, it's possibly because we live in a world, we live in a time 70 years later, 70 years after the publication of this essay, in which this great rift has largely been bridged, although not completely. And from time to time, the bridge shakes and crumbles. But the epic tension and struggle between science and religion, we do not experience it the way those that came before us do. We live in a religious and modern world where these two great realms, religion and science, have to a certain degree, and I don't want to overstate it, to a certain degree, learned to coexist. It's a very important message, and one that here you see why the Rav really is the great hero, the great leader of the movement that we call modern orthodoxy. That sense that there's nothing to be afraid of, that sense that there is no irreparable contradiction between science and faith, between science and religion, the bravery of putting forth such a position, so that we can all live in a world where that has largely been resolved. To some degree, there are other strains in Judaism where this conflict is still felt much more strongly, and that filters down to all movements of Judaism. To some degree, Judaism is influenced as a religious worldview globally, all streams of Judaism, by other religious worldviews that do view science as an attack on religion. And that puts all religions on the defensive. It's unfortunate that we should have to suffer from that. The occasional debates that go around the religious world, and I may be describing a religious community that I occupy, and I don't presume that all of us here online, or those of you that will be listening in the future, that we all share the same zip code, that we all, you know, would fit within the same one box, or self-identify from the same one box. But I'm describing to you the kind of religious community, ideological community, that is, that I occupy and have now occupied for quite some time. That doesn't feel that tension, or that doesn't feel that the conflicts or the contradictions or the apparent contradictions between science and religion are insurmountable. That there are things that we don't understand, that there are ideas that can't on the surface be resolved, but as that old Yiddish expression goes, no one ever died from a question. That we can live with the tension. We can live with the questions. It shouldn't prevent us from getting up tomorrow morning and davening shacharis, nor should it prevent us from stomping our foot on the ground and, you know, saying like Galileo, and yet it moves. If you don't catch the reference, a quick visit to Google will fill you in. That is because if we don't feel those tensions, or if we feel that we can live with those tensions, that's because Rabbi Soloveitchik already paved the way before us by telling us that there's really nothing to fear in the encounter between cognitive man and religious man, between science and faith. And that is, of course, his great gift to the Jewish world. But on the surface, these opposing forces which struggle together in the religious consciousness of the black man, being part religious man and part scientific man, they're not destructive. Halachic man is not some illegitimate, unstable hybrid. On the contrary, out of the contradictions and antinomies, there emerges a radiant, holy personality whose soul has been purified in the furnace of struggle and opposition and redeemed in the fires of the torments of the spiritual disharmony to a degree unmatched by the universal homo religiosus. The struggle between these two worldviews can be overcome, and we can stand on the shoulders, and we can incorporate both of them into our personality, albeit they'll continue to struggle. But you know what? It's not bad to struggle. It's not bad to have tension. And in here, we see the Kantian element, the Hegelian element, in Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. You have two antithetical worldviews that can be synthesized into a greater personality. And we need to understand this personality, the halachic man. But first, in order to do that, he's going to spend about a dozen pages helping us first meet these two component parts before we can figure out how they are put together in this dialectic tension to create a pasuk, katuv ha-shlishi ha-machriya b'nei, a third resolving verse that stands above and greater than the two of them. Next week we'll continue probably from where we left off, although I can't promise that from time to time we're not going to jump around. Try to read ahead. It's probably good for you. Of course, I welcome your questions and comments and thoughts as we move along. And I really, really, really do encourage you to get your hands on a copy of the book. And we will meet again next week.